And tonight we're going to talk with top criminal profiler Pat Brown. She's back with us. We're going to give you some tips on what you can do to help save your family, your kids, your daughter. Her latest work, How to Save Your Daughter's Life, an amazing story from a criminal profiler. And we'll get right into this when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Let me tell you a little bit about our special guest tonight, Pat Brown, nationally known criminal profiler, television commentator, author, founder, and CEO of the Sexual Homicide Exchange and the Pat Brown Criminal Profiling Agency. Pat has provided crime commentary, profiling, forensic analysis in more than 1,000 television and radio appearances in the United States. I think that's probably up to 2,000 by now. And here she is back on Coast to Coast. Pat, I can't believe it's been more than 2 years since you've been on. How are you?
I'm doing good, George. How are you?
Good. Great job, by the way. I got to tell you, as a father of two daughters and now the grandfather of four little girls.
Oh, my God.
I'm telling you, I was reading your book, and it's important. It's scary. It is something, Pat, that I think sends chills up and down my spine whenever I see these stories of these people that are out there. It is just frightening.
You know, I do put it all into one volume, so it's a little bit intense for
yes.
people who are reading it. But I wanted to make sure I hit everything I could think of that might affect somebody's teen daughter's life. It's not good. Each chapter, as people read it, say, oh, you know, that's not going to apply to my daughter. And although I must say, they might find out it does, and that's what's really scary. Is I've run into parents who really think that their daughters are totally safe from many things.
Immune from everything.
Yeah. Yes, and that their daughters are so smart, and that the daughters are never going to have a bad friend, and they're always going to pick the right guy, and they're never going to go to a party and get, you know, plastered drunk and end up date raped. Oh, that's not going to happen to my daughter because she's smart. And I just keep telling parents, oh, come on, look back to when you were that age.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't remember being all that smart, you know. So we do want to help our daughters be as smart as they can be, but we also want to protect them and educate both both our daughters and ourselves what's out there and what to look out for.
Pat, is there a major difference between helping and protecting a daughter as opposed to a son in any particular family?
You know, I don't think there's really a difference, except that that's going to be my next book, How to Save Your Son's Life. I actually got some nasty emails saying, you just only care about girls. I'm like, you know, really, sometimes you can't address everything in one book.
That's right. It takes a while. And the tips, many of the tips are apropos, I think, to both.
That is true. You know, there's always things that we can learn from general safety and things that our daughters, we have to be concerned about, like we have to be concerned about our daughters with, you know, getting involved with drugs, for example. Of course, we have to have the same issue with our sons. There are differences, though.
Yes.
Know, for example, date rape. You know, usually the girl is usually we think of this: the girl is the victim and the guy is the victimizer.
That's right.
You usually think that. But on the other hand, there are girls who file false date rape or just false rape reports, and there are guys they accuse of raping them who did not rape them. So when you have sons, you have to also take that into account and say, look, you go off with a girl you don't know, you've been drinking, and she doesn't like what happens, or she's cheating on her boyfriend.
Good point.
She might go and file a report against you and say, you raped me. So, you know, you can end up having your life ruined from a false reporting, as well as a girl can get raped by a guy while she's out, you know, cruising around and have her life ruined.
Well, you know, and I noticed, too, it's merely the report that could really ruin you. Just the report. You know, even though there's no evidence, you may never get charged. But, you know, if somebody files a report like that, you're tainted, aren't you?
Pretty much, because there's always this weird assumption that, well, no girl would, say that a guy raped her when he didn't. And that's simply not true. Police are very well aware of false reports. And this also affects our girls, because one of the things girls think, and I see this on college campuses, where they're trying to tell the girls, you know, if you get date raped, if you're out with an acquaintance, or you're out on a date and this guy rapes you, come and report it. You got to report it to the police. And I'm thinking, do you know how few of those cases ever see the inside of a court, because almost none of them can be proven?
That's true.
So don't tell girls that it's, you know, go with, no, I mean, I'm saying you shouldn't report it, but I'm simply saying that the girls ought to know up front that it's nearly impossible to win. That's a sad situation, but it's true. It's he said, she said, and if you don't have injuries to your body, How are you going to prove it wasn't consensual if you went with him to his apartment
right.
and you were hanging out on the couch and suddenly you end up having sex and you say, I didn't want it, and he says, yes, you did. So we have to teach our girls the end results can be really bad. And
don't
the same thing for our sons, you know, the end result can be really bad.
That's true. How did you get involved in profiling, criminal profiling?
Oh, well, that was, wow, how long ago was that? 1990. I actually did something. I was thinking about this because I forgot to put it in my book. And
well, you do it. Put it in the next one.
Well, this was about daughters, and you're like, I guess I could, but, you know, I've always rented rooms in my house, and one of the things I point in the out in the book, and I don't know why, I'm probably just protecting myself, but from my bad behavior. But you know, I stayed home to homeschool my children, so I always rented rooms in my house to students, and I was very, very cautious about who I rented to. I have very strict rules. No overnight guests and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, and I always had graduate students. Most of them are from China, so we usually had a wonderful time with our students. But I point out in the book, you have to be careful, you parents, who you bring into the house with your children. So there you go. Luckily, I was home with my children all the time because I homeschooled, so my kids weren't, you know, coming home from school and being at home alone with any of these people. But one time, what happened was, I was in the middle of adopting my third child, and they would not let me have any renters in the house who weren't didn't have a background check and had taken to the police station.
Okay.
And it was really hard to tell Chinese students as they came in from, by the way, we're going to have to take you fingerprinted. Yeah. Okay. See ya. You know.
Yeah.
So I was out of renters, and I was really needed the money. And so my girlfriend said she was dating this guy, and he was looking for a place to stay near where she lived and near the church that they went to, and. And she said he didn't drink, he didn't smoke, didn't do drugs, clean living guy. And so I said, well, I'm not really comfortable with it, you know, because I usually have only college students, but I'll, you know, if he's willing to go to the police station and get, you know, the background check. And he was. So I took him there, he did all that, and then 4 weeks after he moved in, she broke up with him, and I suspected he might have killed the jogger between her house and mine.
No!
Yeah, that's in my book that came out in 2010, The Profiler. Yeah, and it really shook up my world because
I remember you telling me that back in 2010.
Yeah, very scary. And I turned in evidence to the police, and they just completely ignored it, completely. Even though he said he was on the trail that night, and he threw away his clothing from that night. And it took me 6 years to get the case reopened, and it is still open 20 years later, and he is still the number one suspect.
And he's out there somewhere.
Well, you know, I'm not saying he's guilty.
No, I know. You know. I know.
Yeah, I'm saying that I found interesting things. He had interesting behavior that he should have been, you know, looked into. And he was brought in. He did fail the polygraph when he was brought in.
Oh, he did.
Yes, he did. And he, I mean, he gave a squirrely bogus.
Did you get him out of the house?
Yeah, I got him out of the house the next day. I mean, I think, you know, so he was gone. But I was very nervous for a long time, especially after turning in evidence, and they said he was really mad. But this is what got me interested because I said, you know, hey, you know, I turned in evidence. I mean, normally in a serial homicide, this guy would have been a serial killer because this girl was raped and murdered on a jogging path. One problem you always have is that nobody knows who did it.
Nobody knows. No.
You have no idea.
They're so random.
Usually it just goes on for years. The guy gets away with 10 or 20 murders. And here you had a case where you had somebody suspicious right away, the very, very next day. I had a reason to be suspicious because he walked that path every day between my girlfriend's house and mine, and he had thrown all his clothing away, his jeans, his shirt, his tennis shoes, everything, mud-wrapped in plastic from the stream she was thrown in. I mean, you're talking about lots of, you know, all kinds of...
That's weird all by itself.
Yes, and he also called himself the Avenger, and he liked to stalk filth and vermin in the park, according to his little story. But
anyway. Sounds like Ted Bundy.
Oh, he was creepy. He was creepy, and his family agreed with me that he was psychopathic. And so, you know, but anyway, he is not guilty of any crime at this point that we know of. I mean, he could be guilty.
Are other people dying around him?
I have found a few interesting incidents where I believe he's connected with other cases, yes.
Oh,
but, you know, cold cases are almost impossible to reopen. And so since they botched this case into the ground by not bringing him in early, it
Even with DNA out there now, Pat, you know, one little strand of hair, anything, they can't pin this guy.
Well, the girl was in the water.
Okay, so
the girl was in the water, and you know what was there was very degraded. So they didn't have anything at the time, and so things go like that sometimes, and you can't prove much. But what really shocked me about the whole thing was not that they couldn't you know, prove anything, but that they didn't try early on in the case. You know, the day after you have somebody in there, they should have been on his doorstep.
Right. Absolutely.
Interviewing him.
But you were not Pat Brown profiler at that time, were you?
No, I was Pat Brown medical sign language interpreter and homeschooling mom.
Okay. So tell me about that evolution then.
Well, I was so puzzled by it. I think I was really shocked. Very similarly to what happens to a family who their loved one becomes a victim. You know, because the day before you think everything works jolly in the system. You know, and this is, of course, this was 20 years ago before cable was so prominent.
Yeah.
You had so many crime shows on to tell you, you know, there's everybody's killing everybody and we're not catching them. But, you know, back then I never heard of anything. So, you know, I thought, well, you know, I give this to the police and then they're going to do whatever they have to do. And whether they find he's guilty or they charge him with anything or they say no, turns out, odd though it is, there's somebody else. You know, okay, you know, I just want to do my citizen's duty. I wanted to do the right thing, and then nothing happened. And I just kept going, how can this be? So I started studying what happened in serial homicide cases, why they weren't getting solved, why serial killers stayed out there for 20 years. And I found that, quite frankly, cases were misanalyzed. They weren't handled properly. And it took me, I studied for years, and then finally I opened up my own agency to try to address what I see as a major problem and still do.
Have you seen the Showtime show Dexter?
I refuse to watch it.
You won't watch it, will you?
No. Dexter, I think I saw it once and it just made me ill. It's not that I don't have a sense of humor. And sometimes I have a very dark sense of humor because I like Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, you know? He's a good director.
It's not that. You know, Reservoir Dogs is one of my favorite. And I did an actual profile of the guys in that that movie for the 15th anniversary DVD. And it was a lot of fun. I'm like, psychopath, and cop. Okay, there we go. But, you know, so, but something about Dexter, I don't like serial killers being made into likable people.
Little heroes, yeah.
Yes, that makes me ill because no serial killer is that way. Every serial killer that I've ever run into or, you know, listened to or talked to is a cold-blooded snake who cares about nobody except himself.
Exactly. I think he's really more of a vigilante. But you know, they've got him, you know, whacked out, no doubt.
If he did those things, serial killers don't care about anybody else. You know, they don't care about cleaning up society or getting rid of other serial killers or getting rid of bad people. Are you kidding me?
Right.
Serial killers.
Yeah. See, Dexter does. Dexter wants to just do the bad people.
Yeah, right.
So, So to me, it's a vigilante. I don't think
it doesn't work for me. I mean, it's not that I, you know, a lot of shows don't work for me, quite frankly.
It's Hollywood, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, it's just like some lawyers can't watch certain legal shows and some police can't watch certain police shows. I can't watch a lot of the profiling shows. I'll tell you the ones I do like.
What? What do you like?
My favorite is Psych.
Okay.
Psych cracks me up because he's really a profiler.
Yeah.
And he's very honest about it, too. He's like, okay, I got completely wrong on that one. Because he's analyzing. He's looking at things and actually just trying to place them, analyze them, and the show just makes me laugh. So, you know, I enjoy it. And if TNT comes through, there may be a new show on TNT which I might like. It's called Trooper.
Okay.
And it's coming out of Warner Brothers and Jerry. I'm just going to say
Bruckheimer.
Bruckheimer, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. He's going to be the director of it. It's going to be a really great show. And they're doing a pilot. They did a pilot for CBS, and they thought it was going a go, and something freaky happened, and so they didn't take it. So now it's over at TNT. The pilot's being redone.
Okay.
And guess why I like that show?
You're in it.
No. It's the show is based on my book, The Profiler. It was optioned.
Beautiful.
So.
Good
so it's going to be about a divorced lady of three children. I happen to have three, who ends up as a trooper on the, you know, the police, and she has unconventional methods of solving.
Well, see, you are in there, sort of.
Well, I'm
roundabout way.
They've got a really good-looking woman who looks younger and thinner than me. So I'm
Hey, we're going to talk about your work in a second here. You're with me for 3 hours tonight, so lots to talk about, Pat. But what's going on with these feet in tennis shoes that are showing up in Canada? Have you been following that story? It must be about a half a dozen feet have shown up, washed ashore, wearing a tennis shoe, They can't find the bodies. But these feet keep showing up. Now, that's got to be a serial killer.
A couple of them. I didn't think there was more than
that. No, there's been a lot.
Really? I mean, you know, I don't know how I'm overlooked this because I do a lot of stuff for Canada, and I did stuff on the Luca Magnotta case. You know, he's for anybody who doesn't know, he's the guy that decided to kill his roommate on and videotape it and then chop him up, beat him, and it was
truly sick.
And I saw the videotape, so it was really.
Yeah, but there are a number of feet have been washing ashore. They keep reporting that they found another one.
Well, that's interesting. You know, I had not read about that. I know they had two women's bodies that were chopped out, one in Niagara and one in Ontario someplace. But those are not connected cases.
No.
Somebody worried, you know, whether those women, whether they were like copycats off the Luca Magnotta thing. And I'm like, no, neither one of them has anything to do with copycatting. Probably they're just, you know, single crimes that they're trying to get rid of the body. And, you know, sometimes there's two reasons you cut a body up. One is because you don't want to identify it so easily. And the second reason is you can't get the body out of your apartment. So, you know, because you're not living in a house and you can't drag her out to the car.
You got to do it in little pieces, right?
Yeah, so you have to put her in the tub and, you know, put her in little, you know, get some suitcases or something.
What has happened to these people to make them so whacked out to do these things?
Well, we do see a rise now. I think we see a rise in psychopathy in the United States. I believe it's a lot to do with the family breakdown and the narcissism that we're really, I think our kids are really growing up with a lot of that. It's a me society.
Yeah.
And with kids growing up with losing the ability to care about other people and feel that other people are important and worthwhile and thinking that they have to win all the time. You know how, remember when the time when, you know, a kid, you'd have a contest and a kid would win the contest and you get a little prize?
Yeah, a little reward.
And the other kids went home with nothing?
I used to give them to the losers, too. As a parent.
You didn't do that, George.
Why?
Never do that. No, because that's one of the problems.
I wanted the loser kids to feel good.
No, that's the problem. It's we always have to feel good about ourselves. We can never feel good for somebody else. It's always about us. So that's one of the things we've been doing is trying to make every kid feel good no matter what he's doing or how terrible he's doing, and giving him nothing to work for, giving nothing to be proud of when he gets
there. So you're saying I was wrong to do that?
Yeah, I that's one thing.
You
really
cold-hearted person, you.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, it's one thing to give children an opportunity to be successful.
Right.
You know, making things slightly easier. For example, I played Candy Cane with my kids. Candyland. It's been a long time. Candyland with my kids.
It's a board game, right?
Yes. It's, okay. You know, that little one where you run around on little pieces of candy.
I remember
and,
that.
Yeah, 6-year-old can play it, and it's all luck. Because it's all luck, your child will win. But
yep.
If you play a game with your child that is not all luck.
Skill related,
like table tennis, for example. You know, there are a lot of people who will let their kid win. Well, letting their kid win gives them a false sense, first of all, of accomplishment, which is fake. And secondly, it makes them sometimes feel superior to somebody they shouldn't feel superior to, like their parents. Like, you know, if you're an 8-year-old kid and you can beat your mother, you know, your father at table tennis, either you're really a whiz or your parents are letting you win. And you're going, I can beat my mom.
Well, what if you let them win maybe once in a blue moon? Is that better?
No, but the thing is, if they think you're letting them win, eventually they stop trusting you. So, you know, I did two things with my kids. One, I never let them win. And two, I gave them opportunity.
I could see you winning and then putting your hands in the air going, yes, in front of the little
yeah,
kid.
Yeah, I did that sometimes. But I did do handicapping. Handicapping is fair because you know you've been handicapped, but it gives you a chance to, you know, have the thrill of the, you know, trying to get to the
trying to balance things out a little.
Right. So you win the game, but you know you were handicapped. So it's a kind of a win, yeah, but. But, you know, I remember the day my son beat me in table tennis without a handicap.
On his own.
Yes, he did. And he went bursting through the door and started running around the front yard screaming, I beat her! I beat her!
And you were you frustrated or happy?
No, I was fine. I mean, I wasn't like, oh, dang, I can't believe that kid finally.
You tied his tennis shoes together as he went running out, didn't you?
Just a mess.
Pat, we're going to come back in a moment. We're going to take this quick break. We'll be back in a moment as we talk about how to save your daughter's life and much more tonight. I'm George Norrie. Pat Brown with us on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest tonight, Pat Brown, we're talking about her latest work, How to Save Your Daughter's Life, so much more when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. George Norrie back with you, Pat Brown, our guest. Pat, my two little daughters at the time, I used to worry about them every day. Now that they're grown women with their own children, I still worry about them every day. It never goes away.
No, it really doesn't. I mean, you know, I tried to learn when my kids got to be an adult. My adults have three of them, to try not to focus on whether they came, you know, if they were living with me, whether they came home at, you know, what exact time they came home, listening for that gravel in the driveway thing, and when they were overseas, to try not to think, oh my God, this, you know, there's something blowing up where they are.
Yeah.
Which actually did happen to my son. He actually was in Jaipur the day the bombs did blow up, and I told him, here's how to mess your son up. I was in India with him, and he was he had been studying in southern India in Chennai, the University of Madras, and he called me up and said, hey, Mom, you want to come over and travel with me and on my summer break? And I said, oh, what, no money? He's like, yeah, that's right. So it's okay. So I came over and we traveled. We went all over. We went up to Kashmir and down to Delhi and to Mumbai. And in Delhi, we went separate ways. I flew home, and he was going to Jaipur for a few weeks just to do some volunteer work with children. And so I said, you know, I know we've been traveling, David, for about, you know, 10 days. You're probably sick and tired of seeing things like the Taj Mahal and all these other things. But, you know, Jaipur has some beautiful things, a beautiful palace and everything. You should at least go see that, because you might get, you know, once you start working, you probably just, you know, never get around to it. So I said, you're going to have a day off when you get there. Why don't you just go down and see a couple tourist things that are really important, just so you've done it? He says, okay, Mom, I'll do it. I go home to the U.S., and I'm sitting there watching television. It's noon, and I look up at the news, and I hear bomb blasts in India, and there's a big, huge bullseye on Jaipur.
Yeah.
And it turned out there were 9 bicycle bombs that went off right down in the tourist district, right where the palace is.
That's what they did. Yep.
90 people got killed. So I'm picking up the phone. I'm dialing my son's cell phone, and he doesn't answer.
Oh, you're freaking out.
I'm freaking out.
Yeah.
So finally, about an hour later, he picks up the phone. I said, oh, my God, you're okay. And he said, yeah, you know, we've been told to stay inside. And I said, well, were you down there in the tourist area? And he goes, well, no, actually, I was sitting in my room playing video games. Oh, you good son. You didn't listen to your mother.
It worked that time.
So sometimes when they don't listen, it's a good thing. But you know, my kids, they have traveled quite a bit. My daughter's a police detective, and she spent a lot of time on the I've done ride-alongs with her, and so I know what's out there, what my kids are involved with. My other son's a federal officer. So it's, you know, if I spend my time thinking about it all day long, I'll lose my mind.
Yeah, no,
I kind
know.
Of just tell myself not to do that, and, you know, I don't. So, but, you know, things can still happen.
Sure.
You know, even though they're grown, of course.
Well, when you put together your work, how to save your daughter's life, you thought of it in terms of them as children, but also them as grown women and adults as well. It skews all the way.
Well, I started a little, I really was focusing mostly on teen girls, because I think that kind of area tends to be overlooked. We have so many books for little children, how to say no, and, you know, don't touch me and all
right.
that. Right,
stay away, stranger.
Right, yeah. And you know, then they get to, which really most time doesn't work, because kids can't figure that out when the time comes. But, you know, you try what you can do. But, you know, But as they're getting older, sometimes we then just sort of give up. You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's so much work, because now they've got their friends, and now they want to do this, and they want to do that. Now all the social media comes in. So there's a tendency sometimes just to get tired, tired and let things happen. And so I start with the early years in the beginning of the book, just to point out that, you know, when you try to get your teen daughter to listen to you, to respect your decisions, it really helps to already have her respecting you, you know,
that's right.
When she's younger. So, you know, if your kid already is mouthy and you know, and saying nasty things to you and not listening to you,
they're going
to
stay that way for a long time.
Well, when they hit teenage years, hang it up. I mean, your kids are
it's the worst.
Out of control.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying you should really hang it up. I mean, obviously, if you drop the ball, you got to try to get back in the game and try to see what you can do, because it's still your child and you still need to be there. So maybe you just have to say, hey, you know, I'm going to get things back under control. But, you know, it helps to start in the early years. So I do recommend people. So I have a whole section on the early years. And then I move into, you know, teens in high school. What are they going to encounter with going out with, you know, going with friends, dating a boyfriend in high school, you know, bullies in high school, social media, and then on into date rape. And then, you know, also safety issues of physical safety, walking around with the creepy guys out there. And then prostitution is something that girls are getting into, too, as they get into later. Sometimes if they run away from home, they can be prostitutes at 12. But if they, you know, if they get into drugs, they may become prostitutes at 16 or 17 to pay for them. Or when they go away to college, they may decide working at the massage parlor is, you know, some extra money. So, I mean, I'm trying to look at all of the things just might affect your daughter's life. And help you work with her so that each one of these things hopefully won't play a part.
And let's talk about the whole gamut here tonight, Pat, but at any given time, how many truly whacked out killers are out there just looking for their prey?
Way more than we think. And that's really true. I mean, if you look at the serial killer number, I think the FBI for years has said something like 50. Like one
on an ongoing basis, right?
Right. One per state. I'm going to call them on that and say garbage. Way, way more than that.
Way more.
Oh yeah, a few per major city, I would say. Because what happens is serial killers really don't kill every month like Hollywood would have us believe. They tend to kill and then wait 2 or 3 years, 4 years, and do it again. Some kill more often, but others just, you know, when things go bad, they do it and then they wait until they need to do it again when they feel like it. So what happens is they will stop and start. And they might do something, then they'll get married. And then it will do it for a number of years.
And the family would have no idea, right?
Oh, probably not, because, you know, they probably know something. You know, it's funny. Psychopathy is this thing where everybody kind of knows the guy's off.
They'll know something's not
right.
Kilter.
But,
here.
You know,
off
even
kilter.
A serial killer can find himself a wife. And even Carla Homolka, you know, who's a creepy woman up in Canada, who married Paul Bernardo, the serial killer, and he became his partner. I mean, there's somebody for everybody. You know? So
that's true.
You know, they can find somebody. I mean, they may have trouble finding women. They may have trouble dating. And, you know, but eventually they'll sucker somebody in.
Why did they get married?
Well, first of all, sometimes it's because the woman has money and she goes to work every day and he has trouble keeping a job.
Okay.
So that's one reason. A lot of serial killers, especially the kind of the low-level ones, have lower-paying jobs. They really do have trouble keeping their jobs. They get fired because they're obnoxious, they're arrogant, they don't want to listen to the rules. They want it their way. They don't show up for work. They do all kinds of stuff, and they get fired. They blame it on, you know, the employer, of course. You know, it's not my fault.
Right.
But it helps to have a woman with a house.
Could you be next to a serial killer? Maybe you think he is your friend and not even know it?
Oh, absolutely.
Amazing.
Yeah, because what happens is you tend to say he's a little weird. Yeah, I know, he's kind of strange.
Well, everybody's weird in some
way. But some serial killers can be sort of jolly in some ways, you know what I mean? They can be friendly, happy until they kill you, and then they're happy afterwards. But, there's different types. There's types that look creepy, but there's other types that just most of them actually tend to look pretty average.
Yeah, they just fit right in.
Well, they don't fit in well as we think they do. Something is wrong with them, and people complain at work they had problems with them. People complain that, you know, that he doesn't have his friends, doesn't keep them terribly well. He has trouble with dating. I mean, there's always something people say is wrong.
Are they outwardly violent?
No.
So you don't see that? Okay.
No, some of them don't have any criminal records at all. They don't do anything. They're like Boy Scouts until they kill you because they don't want to waste their time with some, you know, little stuff like that. But then there's others who are con men and who will manipulate and do those things as well. So there's a variety of kinds of serial killers, but they can be very friendly. But they are con artists. And, you know, afterwards you go away and you go, something's wrong with that guy.
Yeah.
He tried to snow me somehow. He's a psychopath. You can't hide psychopathy 24 hours a day. It's impossible. But, you know, if you live next to him and he comes out and helps you shovel snow one day for an hour,
mm-hmm.
you might think, oh, he seems like a really nice guy.
Right.
Because you always hear on the television, he's a nice guy. Yeah. Well, how well did you know him? Oh, well, actually, I never spent any time with him at all. Well, that's why you don't know
him. Well, why did he come out and help shovel snow?
To look like a nice guy.
Ah, so it was by design.
Exactly.
He wasn't really a nice guy. He said, I want this guy to think I'm a nice guy.
Correct. And some of them have like superhero complexes where they want to go out and like pretend they're like the savior or this great guy. So it's like, I wouldn't put it past a serial killer, for example, to help somebody and then go kill somebody 5 minutes later.
Right.
Because their whole thing is about feeling in their own minds. Remember, this is only about them. They don't care about anybody else's viewpoint, really. It's about how they feel about themselves. So if they can make themselves feel like a superhero, then they feel good. And killing people, like jumping out of the bushes and grabbing a woman and raping and murdering her, that makes you feel like a superhero, too, because during the day, you're Clark Kent. But
Male serial killers kill women?
Majority of them. We do have usually what happens is heterosexuals kill heterosexuals and homosexuals kill homosexuals.
Okay.
That's just be, and a lot of it isn't really about the sex. It's about the community you're comfortable with.
All right. And what about those that kill couples, for example? You know, they've done that over years.
Well, there's killer couples that work together. Usually just because they urge each other on. Everyone, you know, very rarely do you have ones that go out and kill more than one person at a time. That's fairly rare. But something else that people also don't recognize is that there are female serial killers as well. And
who do they kill? Guys?
They're usually their children.
Children?
Yeah, they can make their own victims, you know, and they can make a victim and then kill it. And then with what we call Munchausen syndrome by proxy, and all of a sudden 9 babies later, like Mary Beth Tinning, it's
right.
Like, wait a minute.
Okay. Well, would a female serial killer who, let's say, kills their own young, are they also killing other children from other families, for example?
Most of the time, they stick with their own. But there are times when they babysat some kid, and oh, look what happened to him. Or they work in hospitals and pull the plug on people, and you know, do things to them so that they can get the big thrill out of what they've done. So they tend to do what we call soft crimes. They don't do really violent stuff. They tend to do the poisoning and the suffocating and those kind of.
Where's the gratification for that? Why do they do that?
Well, there's a number of reasons. One thing is the thrill of being in the midst of, like if you're one of the women who works in a hospital, for example, or a nursing home,
okay.
You're the one who, the bell goes off, all of a sudden there's a code,
you're the first one there.
You're
right?
There and oh my gosh, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so, yeah, so that gives you that cheap excitement. That's one thing. The other thing is to watch people die. Just like the male serial killer likes to watch people die and say, look what I was able to do. You thought I was nobody, and look, I've killed 5 people.
Yeah.
I'm really somebody. But when you have your own children and kill them, I mean, this is a really great deal for some women. First, you get pregnant, and everybody goes running around going, oh, my God, you're pregnant. How cool. Woo! You know,
yeah.
You get all this attention.
And here are
these
gifts.
Then you get bigger, you get attention.
Yeah.
Then you have the baby, you get attention. Then you have to take care of the stupid thing.
And the attention
then you
stops.
It, and you get the attention at the funeral.
Yeah.
So you just want to skip the raising part because that's really annoying, you know? So then once you kill your kid, you get to start the whole process.
What has happened to that person, Pat, for them to even consider doing that? It obviously developed when they were a kid, I would think.
The psychopathy develops very young. Which way it ends up going is another question. Whether that person just becomes a manipulator or a con artist or a politician, lawyer, a preacher, we've seen psychopaths in those fields too, because they can get a flock and they can rip people's money off. And so, they can sometimes gravitate toward fields where they can get that power and control. We have
without killing people.
Correct. And we have police officers. They're, most police officers are fine, but they do once in a while get one of those in their own numbers and go, oh my God, like Drew Peterson,
So, yeah, you get a bad egg. Yeah. That's right.
So there's always, they're drawn to power and control. For the guys, they have a different way of doing it than women, but women get their power and control in their families and communities more so. A little bit less today where women are working out in the field. We see more violent women now than we used to. But traditionally, it's been, let me kill my kids off because that's where I get the...
Is that woman, do you see any signs?
Oh, yeah.
You do.
The same thing is with the males. They're very narcissistic. It's always about them. You know, they can turn it around in a heartbeat, and it's about them no matter what happens. When I worked as a medical sign language interpreter, one of my clients was very psychopathic and very Munchausen syndrome. And she had just had a baby. And I'm sitting in the room with her, horrified, because I knew what she was. Yeah. And the nurse came in and said, are you planning to nurse the baby? And she goes, oh, absolutely. You know, babies are, it's best when a baby has a mother's breast. And then can you show me how to do it? And so the nurse showed her how to nurse. She says, am I doing it right? And a big smile. And the nurse goes, oh, yes, you are. Oh, good. The nurse walked out of the room. She ripped the baby off her breast, tossed it into the crib and said, I hate nursing.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, my God. Yeah. And then she started complaining that people kept bringing the baby presents instead of presents to her.
Instead of presents.
That's a narcissistic, psychopathic female. And she had actually gotten her third... With her pregnant, she actually got that child killed.
Okay.
She would come in all the time when she was pregnant, say that she was having cramps, she was cramping, she was bleeding. She would make up all these stories, and she managed to get a C-section when the child was 6 months old. I mean, 6 months, in the pregnancy, and the child ended up being
stillborn. I would guess.
No, hospital for the deaf, hospital for sick children for a year, but blind, deaf, and retarded, and then died. And she was just thrilled that whole year because she got so much attention being the mother.
All right, what happened to that woman when she was a kid? Something happened to her.
Oh, something serious. Yeah, there's definitely something seriously wrong with her. There's no question about it. She was a really very extraordinarily.
The parents do something to her?
She probably had a pretty bad upbringing. I'm going to say something probably pretty awful. But, you know, also not all psychopaths have parents. You know, if you met your parents, you might like them very much, and they might have tried very hard. Because, then, you know, some parents will say, wait a minute, you know, I didn't make my kid a psychopath.
Well, I would agree with that. You know, even some of these killers, these mass murderers that we've seen, some of their parents seem really good people.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know them all. These are TV clips. But
there generally is something amiss in the family. I will have to say that. I generally think
there's something wrong somewhere.
Yeah. It may not be real obvious. It may not be that they're bad people, but there's something usually.
But, Pat, how many people who go through whatever they've gone through in that family, how many people turn out to be killers?
Right.
And most people don't.
That's correct. And, you know, but people say, you know, what is it? I say it's kind of like a storm that gathers. You know, if you have to have the right personality, which is, you know, a certain personality that the child is born with, then you have to have kind of the right environment that, you know, something wrong in the environment that they're born into, something a little amiss, some kind of attachment disorder that comes up from there. And then, you know, we really don't know what entirely spurs them in that direction. We just don't know.
You know, when
we never will.
When I was a kid, I'd play Guns N' Robbers. I had my cap gun. You know, I had fun. But you know what? I've never shot anybody. I don't have any inclination to. I've been in the military. I'm a concealed weapons permit holder. And I hope to God I never have to use it.
Yeah, well, you know, here is one of the things that, you know, I run into a lot when I talk about violent movies, violent video games, and the dangers of them, is that there's a difference between the proper use of weapons, the use of weapons within a lifestyle like hunting, for example.
Right.
I also own weapons, so when I talk about violent video games, I always laugh because I happen to also believe in we should have the right to carry.
Yeah, absolutely. Me too.
Yeah, and the right to protect ourselves. So I happen to be on that side. But I do note that there is a great difference between having this be a part of a healthy part of life and young children spending 10 hours a day watching and experiencing violence.
Good point.
Through movies and video games, because it's that constant.
Over and over and over.
Exactly. Now, does that make them psychopaths? No, it does not. Because if they're not psychopaths, they're not psychopaths. But if you are psychopathic and highly narcissistic, that can lead you to develop your psychopathy in a very violent direction, as opposed to just being a criminal.
Yeah, there'll be a trigger somewhere.
Right. So that, therefore, instead of becoming a used car salesman and ripping people off, you know, you become a...
Not every used car salesman will rip people off.
No.
Now you know that.
I'm not saying all used cars.
I bought some nice used cars.
There's one place you can do it.
Of course, I did buy one from a guy named Eddie. Got to go back and see Eddie one day.
But there's, you know, there are definitely careers you can get into, which you can use your con artist techniques and get over on people in a legal way or maybe a nonviolent illegal way. But we have an increasing amount of psychopaths who get a thrill out of the violent side of it. I think that is being increased through young people spending way too much time with that kind of ideation.
I think you're right. And what about the breakdown of the family? Does that contribute to it?
Oh God, yeah. You know, because you know you're just leaving kids out there. You know, you're leaving kids without role models, without comfort, without, you know, without the family dinner. You know, everybody's rushing around, leaving them to their own devices. And a lot of times, because of that, we leave letting children grow up like Lord of the Flies. You know, figuring it out for themselves, and we're throwing junk at them in order to keep them amused, you know, because we don't have time for them. And that's one of the things I point out in my book, How to Save Your Daughter's Life, is that, you know, if you're in a situation where your daughter doesn't have a real solid home life, you know, maybe perhaps you are divorced, single parent, whatever, and you know, everybody's working too much and she's on her own too much, and,
right.
You know, and you get too tired to deal with her, you know, and you just let her run around. That you have to really work hard to find ways to give a stable life. Sometimes it means moving in with your parents, you know, in order to give your daughter grandparents in the house.
Pat, we're going to come back. We're going to talk more about your work, How to Save Your Daughter's Life. We'll get into some specifics here. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.